And now I'd like to introduce tonight's guest. As founder of the Thomas Road Baptist Church in 1956, Reverend Falwell has presided over a huge increase in his church's membership. His leadership of the Moral Majority, which he founded some 7 years ago, and his many appearances on radio and television have made him one of the most influential and controversial religious leaders in the nation. Reverend Falwell is now the president of the Liberty Foundation. Tonight, Reverend Falwell will be discussing the political power of the evangelical movement. And so, without any further ado, I now present Reverend Jerry Falwell.
Thank you, Jim. My message tonight will be about 30 minutes in length, and you'll be getting at least twice that much. And I promise to do my best to answer, and what I don't know the answer to, Jim does. The monolithic nature of the evangelical vote, does it exist? Does it not exist? 1976, for the first time, the evangelical vote became a factor in American politics when the former governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter, announced he was born again and was running for president. In the aftermath and the pall that followed Watergate, and the nation looking after and grappling for moral leadership, Jimmy Carter unabashedly appealed to people who believed like he believed to support him. Obviously, there was an outcry then, just as there is now. And obviously, he had some negative fallout, just as exists today. But nevertheless, he ran on that ticket and on his personal faith in Christ. And during that time, the Gallup poll decided to determine if that vote existed. And as a result, the born-again constituency of this country was considered by Gallup to be about 34%, surprisingly, to all of us on all sides of the issue. Somewhere between 60, 70 million persons, whether Roman Catholic or Protestant or whatever, professed that they had had a new birth experience with Jesus Christ. And whether the number is in reality 25 million or 60 million or 70 million is all irrelevant. The fact is that in a very close election in 1976, most would agree that the fact that he, Jimmy Carter, received a 2-to-1 support from the evangelical vote clearly accounted for his victory. 4 years later, in 1980, that same constituency, by a 2-to-1 margin, voted for his opponent, Ronald Reagan. And while Ronald Reagan had a landslide victory in 1980, obviously that number of persons was a significant contributor to his victory. And in 1984, with a 16.5 million plurality, and getting not a 2-to-1 margin, but an 84% margin of the evangelical vote, it became very, very clear that Ronald Reagan had learned how to put together a very tenuous coalition between economic conservatives and social conservatives. Bill Rusher, who wrote a book that was published by Mara in 84 entitled The Rise of the Right, spoke of that that coalition of economic conservatives and social conservatives as being the majority that the Republican Party now enjoys and that has helped them win two presidential elections and change the makeup of the U.S. Senate. But he also talked about the fact that come 88, whoever that candidate happens to be representing the Republicans, they have the very difficult task, whoever that person is, of keeping that constituency, the economic conservative, which include the yuppies, the young urban professionals, and others, content with that 20% of social conservatives, which would contain the Bernard Laws and the John O'Connors and the conservative Roman Catholics and the evangelicals and fundamentalists and Pentecostals and Mormons, etc., that 40% and that 20% together to keep the Republican Party a majority party. Millions of persons who were heretofore uninvolved in the process have in recent days become involved. For us in the evangelical camp, most of us preached sermons in the 60s and the early 70s on why we should not be involved. I actually printed one of those sermons. I've tried to buy it back. But we we find copies everywhere we go on why we should ignore what Jesse Jackson and Father Dryden and now Pat Robertson and others are doing, and why we should stay in the pulpit and preach the gospel and pray and call people to faith, but why we should not be involved in social and political issues. Somewhere, and I would say 1973 was a watershed year, somewhere we began to change our mind. I suppose the Roe versus Wade decision was a major, major catalyst. But I would say the breakdown of the family, the approach towards a 50% divorce rate in this country, the pornographic explosion of the 60s and the 70s and the drug epidemic, and add to that a great deal more that disturbed a lot of Americans, particularly caught the attention of evangelical ministers in so much that that which we were shying away from, social issues, became almost centerpiece with us. And in 1979, we formed the Moral Majority, which was the first of several hundred political, religious, and political groups that of a conservative nature have been formed since then. In 1979, as we looked around and did our own polls, we found that 55% of the evangelicals of this country, and I use the term evangelical to encompass the Pentecostals, the Charismatics, the traditional Christians of the Billy Graham, Charles Stanley, Jerry Falwell variety, the Charismatics of the Pat Robertson and Jimmy Swaggart and other Pentecostal groups. The evangelicals had a 55% registration of eligible voters, and at that time the national average was 72%. It's just slightly higher than that now, but substantially below the national average. And more significant than the fact that only 55% were registered was that of that 55%, a small minority were actually participating in the political scene. There was almost a psychological barrier that prevented these millions of evangelical Christians, whatever the number is, from actually being informed and involved and voting and working for candidates and lobbying for legislation, etc. And uninvolvement, non-involvement, really was that characteristic behavior politically of the evangelical church, and had been for about 50 years. You don't have to look far back in history to find the church much involved, whether it be the black militia in Revolutionary War days, or the Wilberforces back of that, or Charles G. Finney and the abolitionist movement that broke the back of slavery in this country, or more recently the William Sloan Coffins of a school I can't think the name of in the 60s, and others. You would find clergymen out there particularly involved on social issues from the left and the right. And so for us in 1979 to begin to get actively involved broke no precedents with history, only with our own philosophy. We had come to believe that religion and politics don't mix was a verse in the Bible. And we had come to believe that, and we'd been taught that in seminary, that we should actually take the Quaker position and literally refuse to be involved in anything that had to do with non-spiritual, as we defined it, activity. Well, that we began to break that barrier, and we began to register voters. And since 1979, 8.5 million persons have been registered by these many conservative groups in the evangelical camp, which has been added to that overall 20% of social conservatives that Bill Rusher talks about. Lewis Harris in 84, just before the presidential election, reported that 20% of the electorate was now, in fact, in that, they called it moral majoritarian, but really a broader, much broader social conservative group that involved conservative Catholics, Orthodox, conservative Jews, and a large, large number of evangelical Christians. And they not only were voting, they were voting almost unanimously behind one kind of candidate, namely Ronald Reagan. And the question being asked was, how monolithic is this vote, and can this vote be counted on by, in this case now, the Republican Party? I think in a few moments I can point out to you that the answer to the question is the vote monolithic is both yes and no. But I think I can also point out to you that the Republican Party does not own that vote. The majority of the voters in our own group, Moral Majority, Old Time Gospel Hour, we have 7.5 million families on our computers who are part of our ministry and who write to us, and many support us. That would be 20 or 25 million persons. The vast majority, like the cross-section of this country, would be Democratic in registration. But who have not, who have, in the last few years, have not been voting for, at least rarely, Democratic candidates, while at the same time never abandoning their commitment to a Democratic registration. Jimmy Carter came in as a born-again Christian, and on that premise, and without a great deal of information, our people, by a 2-to-1 margin, supported him. And he, in the next 4 years, proceeded to vote against everything his constituency, in that constituency, believed in, and standing pretty much for everything they were against, etc., so that during the next 4 years, though those were embryonic days, we, as far as formation and sophistication were concerned, he did lose the vote by the same margin in 1980. However, an educational process began in 1979, 80, 81 of our people, and we did it through pastors. Now, the black church during civil rights days used the local churches as the power base politically to bring an end to the civil rights violations in this country. And all of us in those early days looked on that as an aberration, an oddity, a peculiar thing, that a church would be used as a political base. Today it's a part of the process. Jesse Jackson's running for president, which I assume he's doing again. He will speak in those black churches, raise money for his candidates in those black churches, and none of us think that that is abnormal or should not be done. It has been and was and continues to be the place where the black community, through its pastors, can muster the strength and the voice and the necessary influence to achieve their goals. But it has been very difficult these past 7 years to overcome the bigoted feeling against the evangelical church doing the same thing in this country. And it has just been in recent days that it's being now gradually but surely accepted as a part of the political fabric in America. Registering voters, but more important than that, reactivating the uninvolved millions of voters, and that required education. In the past 7 years, we've been able to enlist over 100,000 pastors, over 100,000 pastors who have been trained, who have been informed, who have, many of them, become articulate spokespersons for the cause, and who, contrary to 7, 8, 10, 15 years ago, when they were totally uninvolved, today are becoming champions of the very issues that they've always believed in, but allowed some Roman Catholic person or some other spokesman out there to say what they wanted said. That isn't true anymore. And today with that, and through the pastors to the people, speaking to millions every week in their pulpits and in the pews, and to the disdain of many who don't appreciate that. These people have been mobilized, but they've also been informed on issues so that they do not accept the philosophical claims of their congressmen or their two senators or their city councilman or their president simply because he or she happens to say, I am a conservative, I am committed to free enterprise, I am committed to the pro-life position, and so on. They look at, very scrutinizingly, the voting records of those persons and then decide, is this person close to what I believe in? The vote is monolithic, very monolithic on principles. But the vote is not monolithic on party. Why did the evangelicals move into the Republican Party so heavily in the last 7 or 8 years? Well, first of all, we were allowed to have some voice in carving out the 1980 platform in Detroit and later the 84 platform in Dallas. We were allowed to come in and share our concerns, and there was a response to it. So that in the Republican Party platform, there happened to be a very, very strong overture and commitment to values that were not just Ronald Reagan, though they were that, but very much committed to the social conservative agenda, not totally, but far more so than the Democratic platform. But I repeat, the majority of our people, as would be the case in this room or most areas where groups get together, would be of Democratic registration because that's the national cross-section. But they're not committed in a monolithic fashion to the Republican Party, and there are many, many in the mainstream Republican Party who do not appreciate the advent of these social conservatives. They're also smart enough to know that without them they cannot win, and they have a terrific dilemma of deciding whether to be happy losers or unhappy winners. And it's a good spot for us to be in. We are not a majority, but we are the necessary voting bloc for the Republican Party to win. The Republican Party has been, throughout many, many years, made up of a 40% vote economic conservatives. And that's a nice, that's a large group, but it just happens to be 10.1 percentage points beneath what is necessary to win. And only when they have a hero like an Ike or somebody who's a national hero have they been able to win a position, a national race. That is not true anymore. And they do, in fact, have what Kevin Phillips said in a book he published very prophetically in 1969 on the emerging Republican majority. They do have the opportunity now of putting together a coalition that is far less tenuous than was Roosevelt's, that won for the Democrats presidential elections from 32 through 48. The question is whether or not the party at the RNC and at the highest levels is willing to work at bringing together economic and social conservatives to the degree that both learn how to give a little and take a little and be willing to accept 65% as opposed to 5% somewhere else. I would say that our group is more difficult in that area, and we're having perhaps a more difficult time as the leaders, but we are winning that process. For example, most Roman Catholics on the abortion issue would not be willing to make concessions where rape, incest, and the physical life of the mother are concerned. We are. We've been having to battle that and somehow along the way not lose our people who sometimes would rather lose totally than not get everything they want, and to develop a pragmatic point of view and attitude inside a religious camp is clearly more difficult than inside the camp of those who do not have a religious persuasion towards their convictions. But it's happening. It really is happening. And we're getting people together. It's been one of the most remarkable phenomena of the past 7 years. Has been getting together Roman Catholics and Mormons and evangelicals and fundamentalists and Protestants of all varieties who have learned they can sit down together without losing their theological integrity and who have learned they can work together for an overall cause. Those who are more liberal have known that for years. They can fight like cats and dogs for 4 years and then have a big party right ahead of election time, get together, elect their candidate, and go to war the next day. But conservatives haven't had that luxury. It's either slay utterly or don't go to the party. And fortunately, that is changing, and particularly because of the leadership of a lot of outstanding pastors who are working day and night to bring their people to a pragmatic position where we're committed not to the party, but where we're also willing to sit down with persons and give and take. Neither is this group of social conservatives, and particularly the evangelical vote, committed to a person. Jimmy Carter was an evangelical Baptist. In 1980, it was this evangelical vote that disenfranchised him. That may be why he told me to go to hell last week. I don't know. But I'm not going to go. I'm not going to do that. And respectfully, I disobey. But at any rate, it was these evangelicals who elected a nominal Presbyterian, and there's difficulty proving that, over an evangelical Southern Baptist, because our monolithic voting pattern is on principles only. So what are those principles? What are the things that really are at the top of the agenda, the laundry list, for not just social conservatives, but I'll speak now for the evangelical vote that I think is by far the majority of the social conservative vote. Without a doubt, it is our position on abortion. We have very, very strong feeling that our lack of commitment to the dignity of unborn life is a national cancer, and that it is very devastating to our commitment to other principles, and it has been for now 13 years, has resulted in the, come Christmas, about Christmas time, 20 million unborn children dying. That is a matter of serious concern with us, because we happen to believe that life begins at conception, and regardless what you believe, if you believe that, or believe we believe that, you can understand why we feel as we do on that issue. Right along with that would be our commitment to family, traditional family values. We look on many of the issues, and that's why we fought so hard on the, in the area of pornography and drugs. We believe those are very devastating to the family in this country, and those are very important things with us, and we very much applaud what has been done, is being done. The Mies Commission was a commitment to a promise and a fulfillment of a promise to us, and we appreciate what has happened. 25,000, actually a few more than that, retail stores have removed pornography from their shelves. The evangelical vote would be strongly anti-communist and would have a very, very unrelenting commitment against Marxism. And we look on socialism as mutually shared poverty. And we work very hard to do our best. I was supposed to speak to business school, and I turned it down for you guys. I had that for them. Interview here, all right. We're very strongly anti-communist, and unashamedly so. We're also very strong on defense, and we very much appreciate the president's position on SDI and support for the freedom fighters in Central America and Afghanistan and Angola, etc., and or anywhere else for that matter. And the evangelical vote is very supportive of the state of Israel. And we would have great difficulty with any candidate who is not committed to the security and the integrity of the state of Israel as our best national friend in the world. And those would be, and there are many other lesser, but those are the basic issues around which the evangelical right has gathered and galvanized. And for me, I have found, for example, in George Bush, the person I am willing to support and work for. I have many preacher friends who have found Jack Kemp to be that person. There are many others who are working behind Pat Robertson, and I'm sure Bob Dole or whoever, Pierre DuPont, others come to the forefront. You'll find many evangelicals in behind those candidates, and between now and 88 and the convention, working very hard for the person that they believe is the right one. But come convention closing time in 88, unless the Democrats have changed their platform, and unless they have somebody other than Harda Cuomo running as their candidate, I can't think who it is right now. I do know a couple, but I don't want to suggest them for fear they'll nominate them. It is very, very likely that that candidate in 88 who is supporting that Republican platform will get, as Reagan did, at least an 84% vote of confidence in November of 88 for the next presidency. Now, the question, of course, has to be brought in as to whether the economy is still level at that time and if other major international problems have not erupted. All those are factors. But assuming the condition in 88 at election time is as it is today, it is my opinion that the social conservatives will join with the economic conservatives and elect the Republican candidate, whoever it happens to be, the next president of the United States. I want to come back for just a moment here, because I know you're thinking it, and at Q&A time you can voice it. Why are you not supporting Pat Robertson? Why are you supporting George Bush? It is my conviction that in selecting a candidate, the first issue always is competence. Who is the most competent and capable, and who is the most
experienced person for that office. Now, that's not a put down of Pat Robertson or Jack Kemp or Mr. Hart Pence. Hart, I'm sorry. Or whoever. That is not a put down. I happen to think that Pat Robertson, Jack Kemp, Bob Dole, and a few others that the Republicans may have in 88 as their candidate are all very capable, very competent persons. But if you ask who in the list is most competent, I don't think there's any question that George Bush, by his very experience in Washington, unfortunately, they call him Mr. Resume. But I think more than competence, he also has in the past 6 years gravitated very sincerely to the Reagan agenda. I believe that he is just as conservative on the issues that are important to us and hopefully to economic conservatives as is Ronald Reagan. And I believe when you add the competence and his commitment to the principles that are dear to us, it'd be very difficult to find a person in this country who is more qualified to be the next president. That is my feeling, and that is why I'm with him and for him and will be working for his election. But I have told Jack Kemp, and I have told Pat Robertson, and I will tell Bob Dole and all the rest who are committed to the issue, that if you win the nomination, we would just as quickly support you for the presidency, because we very much believe that what Reagan has begun must be continued. The evangelical vote is not monolithic by party, by person. It is by principle. It is not Republican in nature. It is Democratic in majority, but it's committed to those candidates who are most committed to the principles that are dear to us. We look for competence. I don't think for a moment that because a person happens to be an evangelical, that he or she is the best candidate and we should vote for that person. I often tell the story of a man in our church who's 84 years old. He happens to have had no opportunities for formal education as a boy, went to the fifth grade. He doesn't write at all, reads very poorly. But he's one of those men who has, I believe, as personal relationship with the Lord as anybody I've ever known. And I make no bones about it. When I have a personal need, a problem, where I feel the personal need of prayer, I go to this man who's just called affectionately Brother Worley in our church. I go to him before I do any minister to please pray for Jerry Falwell. I also have a good friend who is an atheist who happens to be the finest neurosurgeon in our state. If I have a brain tumor, Brother Worley's not doing the surgery. That atheist is going to do for it, brother, do the surgery. Brother Worley's going to pray for him. And that is how I feel about the presidency. That's how I feel about the Senate. That's how I feel about the House of Representatives. And that is how I feel every person should vote. I think competence should first be at the top of the list. And right behind that, commitment to principles, and obviously in a pluralistic society, we look for that person who is closest to what we are looking for, whether we be a labor union or a feminist group or an evangelical voting bloc or whatever, like everyone else, looking for the person who's closest to what we believe in. The significance of the evangelical vote today in this country is that we have come together. We have learned it isn't wrong to be involved. Our people have been and are being educated on the issues that we feel are vital. The pulpit is the once or twice a week platform from which the information is being dispensed, but publications and broadcasts are now legion. And in the years to come, this is as much a part of the political scene in the country, and will be permanently, as is the black civil rights vote, as is the feminist vote, as is the labor union vote. And none of it is dangerous to any of the rest of us as long as everyone is getting a fair shake and everyone is getting the opportunity to participate. We do not think, I do not think, that this is God's platform and that anybody running is God's candidate. I believe that in a free society like ours, we look for that person who is closest to what we believe in, and where he or she may go to church is incidental, if in fact they do go to church. I think I'll close by just leading into the Q&A, and that is this. In the past 7 years, since we began forming and putting together the evangelical vote, Lewis Harris says it's 20%. I don't know what it is. I don't think anybody really knows what it is. But since we have begun doing that, we had to begin like every other group. We had to begin with a lot of procedural errors.
We had a lot of loose cannons out there. We'll have some more in the future, who get their mouths going before their minds are in gear. We've had some embarrassing participations of various natures. I still read of a candidate saying that the Christians won this one, or the Christians won that one. But I think that maturity and growth and development is a part of anything that's wholesome and good. And I want to read to you what I believe to be a pretty good synopsis of this coalition that, if the Republicans are smart enough to keep it together, can ensure them election victory after election victory. Again, it was William Rush who wrote July 24, 86 in his national syndicated article through the Newspaper Enterprise Association on the conservative advocate's strange political bedfellows. He said, and I quote, "It would be a mistake, however, to suppose that a coalition is unworkable," speaking of yuppies, economic conservatives, social conservatives, evangelicals, "that a coalition is unworkable or even vulnerable simply because its components have their own disagreements." H.L. Mencken described the Democratic Party of the 1920s as two gangs of natural enemies in a precarious state of symbiosis. He was referring to the Irish-run northern city machines and the courtly racists who dominated the Democratic state organizations in the South. But that unlikely coalition, far from being precarious, was the foundation of the still larger and even more diverse group of political allies that became known as the Roosevelt Coalition, which, by the way, won every election from 32 through 48. Be glad to entertain your questions. I see a lot of prepared speeches there, and I'm willing to listen. I've got nowhere to go for 45 minutes, but if you can get past the first eight paragraphs, read the question. Thank you.
Hello?
Got a Democrat back there. By first saying that what the New York chairman of the Moral Majority did, we have no response. He was dismissed the next day. These were some of the loose cannons we had. The Washington Star, which went out of business the next day after writing that article, I don't know what the connection was, said that I said at the state capitol steps in Virginia in 1978 that the stereotypical statement that a Jew can make more money accidentally I was speaking to some anti-Semitics, make on purpose and you're jealous. I did make that statement, and I did apologize to the Anti-Defamation League the next day. It was national media everywhere. That was 8 years ago. And those are the only statements, and that, I assume you weren't reading, you wouldn't have probably seen the back page, but that was done 8 years ago, and those statements and nothing similar to them have been made since then. And I've been very careful and growing in sensitivity in the past 7 or 8 years that we have been out in the public arena with these issues, even with short comments that once not a public figure and not sensitive, we did make. But the only statement that I'm guilty of, that was the one I just quoted. We apologized to ADL the next day. We fired the gentleman who made the other statement in New York, and I don't know how we can go beyond that. Thank you. Yes, sir.
No citations, that's a simple question.
Okay.
And that is about the recent name change of the moral majority to the Liberty Foundation. I mean, I want to ask you...
Federation.
Is it indeed just a name change? Is it a new organization? If so, where is the moral majority? And also, if you are concerned at all with the other organizations who use the word Liberty in their title, which have a tendency to be on the extreme right wing.
Okay, Liberty Federation, not Liberty Foundation. And... we still have both organizations. The moral majority is now 7 years old, plus a few months. We, in January of this year, added the Liberty Federation to embrace a broader agenda, which happens to be pretty much the Reagan agenda, SDI and support for freedom fighters being a major part of that. Moral majority has stayed with its narrow agenda that I read a few moments ago, the abortion, family issues, support for Israel. But we have moved defense issues and Star Wars, et cetera, into Liberty Federation. Both are, and we hope this continues, enjoying their biggest year right now ever. Thank you. Yes.
In light of your willingness to make concessions, how do you feel about recent developments concerning U.S. policy towards South Africa?
I think the Congress made a terrible mistake in overriding the president's veto. I would agree with Dr. Bach here that while apartheid is reprehensible and needs to be ended, that to divest of all involvement financially in the country is simply removing all possible influence to effectively remove apartheid in that country. And personally, having been there before and having been there twice recently, and having talked with elected black leaders all over the country, including the Soweto Town Council, elected by the citizens of Soweto, talking with Chief Buthelezi's people, head of the largest black tribe in the country, the Zulus, talking with other tribal leaders elected, I've yet to find one person that agrees. I'm speaking now, not the whites, I'm speaking of the blacks, the coloreds, the Indians. I'm yet to find one elected black leader in all of South Africa who agrees with the Congress position on sanctions or the position of many on divestiture. Reason being, as the mayor of the city of Soweto said, Pastor, while we want to see apartheid come to an end, and we want as quickly as is possible to see equality in every way in this country, we are not willing to see our children starve for lack of jobs and income by something as radical as outsiders would suggest. And it's exactly what I read in Time magazine that Dr. Bach is saying. Yes, the end must come to apartheid. No, we mustn't solve one problem and create another one. The two problems that are seldom talked about in South Africa, one of them is the existence of a very radical right-wing part of the National Party that is unbelievably close to wresting the power away from P.W. Botha's government. And while there have been, ever so slowly, some advances and reforms under Mr. Botha, at the same time, this right-wing feels that he is a pussyfooter, a compromiser, that he's a pragmatist who's about to give away the country, and with the military might that is available to that government, should this radical right-wing take power, it is a concern of many who have been watching it very closely and working in Washington with the government, working in South Africa with all elements. It is the opinion that would be a very dangerous thing. The other side of the coin is when one looks at Zimbabwe, and I was there in 1979 when Nkomo and Joshua Nkomo and his Marxist forces and Robert Mugabe and his Marxist forces were vying for the control of the country, Mugabe winning, of course. I well remember when that came down and the whole international media was crying for that to happen. Bishop Muzorewa, a very fine black leader of that country, was swept aside. And today, last year, for example, Mugabe killed 7,000 black activists in Nkomo's forces, far more than have died in South Africa, totally and entirely. This happened in a matter of weeks. We don't want to see another state taken over by Marxists who have no regard for human life, regardless whose life it is, or another Mozambique, or another Ethiopia, or another, we don't want to see a right-wing dictatorship such as Uganda has been through so horribly and terribly. What I'm saying is that there are some things that, like in this country, 170 years invested in changing our own apartheid. Very difficult in 32 years to demand immediate change. It must come. I agree with President Reagan. I agree with President Bach. I agree with many others in this country. And we mustn't allow the national media to paint this as a racist issue when, in fact, it is not that. A person can be on both sides of this issue and very sincere and very fair and see wanting to accomplish the same goals but see different avenues of achieving it. So that is where I stand. Yes, right here.
I have two related questions. The first being, was Jesus Christ a pacifist? And second, if so, how do you reconcile a belief in Christianity with advocating a defense policy based on nuclear deterrence?
I believe Jesus Christ was and is a pacifist. I believe he's eternal God, always was, ever shall be, and that it was his love that took him to the cross to bring us to peace with his Father. I do not equate self-defense with a violation of pacifism. I have never physically hurt any person. I hope I never, never do. The only incident where I would perceive that I could or would injure someone would be if, during the night or whatever, someone attempted to hurt my family. I would feel, again, from an admonition from our Lord, that he who does not care for his own household is worse than infidel. I would defend my family by whatever means were available to me. I also believe the same thing corporately as a nation. I believe that our government, not only in the Constitution, but certainly there, but as well, morally, has the responsibility of defending the populace. I wish we lived in a perfect world where there were no Adolf Hitlers and no Mussolinis and no Gorbachevs and no Castros. I wish we and no Ortegas. And I wish we lived in a very sweet society where self-defense were not necessary. But I noticed when I arrived here, the sergeant met me over here. He's thinking some of you might misbehave. And, of course, I know you wouldn't. But I came here to Harvard, and I met somebody who's here to keep the peace. And I'm glad he's there. You never know. There may be. Yes, sir. I'm for you, buddy. And I always say to some very sincere people on this issue that a person who really is a committed pacifist should have the right to exercise that. I in this country, we have had and we do now have the right for a person with a genuine religious philosophy towards pacifism not to be involved in combat. That isn't new to this country. It's still, the conscientious objector still has an avenue to practice his religion and still serve his country. But what I also say to the pacifist is, give to the rest of us the right to defend your right to be a pacifist. Give to the rest of us the right to maintain the peace and to keep the peace so that we all can go to bed safely. And sometimes I meet those who are saying, no, I want to impose pacifism as the doctrine of the country. And I say, if you really believe that, and there's a Baptist, by the way, I'm not just talking to Quakers here. I have a Baptist preacher friend who is a theologian, teaches in a Baptist college in Pennsylvania, Ron Sider, who has, in his book, made the statement that we ought to unilaterally disarm, totally and entirely, and we ought to assume that the Soviets have good intentions and would reciprocate. And I said to Ron on a national TV show, I said, okay, Ron, what happens if they don't reciprocate properly? Well, then we should meet them at the borders with flowers in one hand and placards in the other saying, God loves you. And that would, I said, Ron, that might succeed because they might laugh themselves to death. But but a few of them might survive that and line the rest of us up against the wall. But I said, if you really believe that, what you ought to do is three things. If you really want to be consistent on the pacifism view, number one, don't ever lock your door again. Don't ever sleep behind a locked door. If you can trust the Russians or whoever, you certainly ought to be able to trust your neighbors. Secondly, begin a real campaign to get rid of all law enforcement officers, all peacekeeping, police, security, everywhere, school, city, everywhere. And third, the next time you're in New York, spend the night in Central Park. And the fact is, this is not the kingdom of heaven, it's the kingdom of earth.
and there's some bad people in it, and Hitler wasn't the last of the train. They're still coming out down the road. And we have a responsibility to see to it that we can hold a meeting like this and nobody can stop us. We have a responsibility to see that you and I can disagree on something as sacred and as noble as this subject is without fear that somebody's going to shoot the one of us or later. Punish us in some way. And that can only be done by the ability to defend oneself, and that is not warlike. That, to me, is peacekeeping in nature. So while we probably would disagree on the conclusion we've arrived at, I would hope that you would grant to us who believe as we do the same thing that we would grant to you, and that is to never participate in combat of any kind while others do it so you don't have to do it. Thank you.
Reverend Falwell, in looking at your laundry list of the critical issues for the evangelical movement, I begin to wonder, how tenuous is the Reagan coalition really, and how much longer are the evangelicals going to remain satisfied on issues like abortion and school prayer? You know, there's been very, very little movement. There's been some talk, but very little real policy and legislative movement. And as far as anti-communism and a strong defense type posture goes, I don't see any reason inherently why the Christian movement should be drawn towards strong, aggressive defense policies. It doesn't seem like a strong way to build a coalition over time. And how much longer are you going to be
satisfied? All right. Well, I think I would disagree with that. I think we've made tremendous progress. For example, with the addition of Antonin Scalia to the Supreme Court and before him, Sandra Day O'Connor, a court that voted 7-2 in favor of abortion on demand in 1973 is very likely today a 5-4 court. It is very likely in the next 2 years, 2.5 years, that Ronald Reagan is going to get one or two more appointments to the court. You said that 2 years ago when I was here. We got two since then. And all we need is one more. And so on the abortion issue, I personally think that we're going to see reform come from the judicial arena. I think it's going to be modifying in nature, not reversal. I think you're going to see perhaps the court at some point in time either throwing it back to the states or probably instead modifying to some degree where rape, incest, physical life of the mother. I think in the process, if we expect to win that one, and we're trying very hard at it, we need to offer a better way. In our ministry, we have already created 500 homes nationally. We're trying to start 10,000 of them, ministering to 150 primarily teenage girls annually. We call it the Liberty Godparent Ministry. We have worked with 25,000 girls the last 5 years, starting with one home. We have 500 now who have not had abortions, who have given birth to their children. Many are very young. We are also a child placement agency. We have 100 qualified families meeting all state criteria, in our case, spiritual criteria as well, waiting for every baby we have to place. Last year, there were 5 million applications for a child to adopt. There were only 50,000 babies placed for adoption last year. 100-1 is the ratio. And so we've got to, number one, create the alternatives for the 1.5 million women who do not have abortions in this country, free, no cost to anybody. And at the same time, seek for judicial reform. And I think it will take, even after the court's reconstructed, some time to do it. Mr. Reagan will have in place by 88 in the federal court system, at the appellate level and the district level, 52% of the court members will be his appointees. And if you're watching his appointments, they're just as committed to the Reagan agenda as Roosevelt's were to his. I mean, that's the idea of being president. And as far as the anti-communist thing, how does that fit into the Christian agenda? I happen to appreciate religious freedom. I happen to know, because I'm involved in 66 nations with our ministry of a Christian ministry. We have right now churches behind the Iron Curtain. Churches in communist states and in other places are not doing very well, if at all. And many, like Solzhenitsyn, have paid a price physically for their religious freedom. I like the idea here in this country of the way we do it. I'm glad there's room for a Jesse Jackson. Hey, I'm glad for him to run for president as long as he loses. And I'm glad in this country for the way we can do it. I can come up here and you pay me to give you the devil. And then I invite Harvey Cox down to our place, and he pays me back. But that's what America's all about. That's what it's all for. And frankly, I think we are making progress. I think that we're not back yet, as we would define back. But I think we're on the right track. I think we bottomed out. I think marriage is back in vogue, believe it or not. Family values on the way back, and I'm really encouraged. Yes, sir.
May I just follow up with one small question? I'm optimistic, too, but with the abortion thing, there's two ways to win it. You can win it legislatively, judicially, or you can win the minds of the people. And that's what I mean. That's where progress hasn't been made. Reagan's been lucky, and he's gotten some judges in there, and you may get it that way.
More
that's not going to change anybody's mind. And maybe somebody's going to come down the road in 10 years and unwind it again. We're just going to be right back where we are now, 23 million abortions.
But you'll notice he's appointing 50-year-old men and women. He's got that in mind. Hopefully,
See what I mean?
I know what you're saying, and I agree with you. I, for example, the drug issue. Nothing more hypocritical in the world than that drug bill that came through the Congress the other day. It happened to come through right before November 4th, And the issue is not clobbering everybody. You shoot everybody in the country, but until you get rid of the demand, like prohibition, you're going to have the drug traffic. Now, I'm for the penalty side of it, but that doesn't cure it. That doesn't stop it. And we've got to have a massive education program from every authority figure in the country, school teachers, parents, pastors, television. It's got to become where the little child at age 4 hears, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, and here's why, all the way so they don't destroy their minds and bodies. The same thing with the abortion issue. It is not enough. By the way, the 25,000 women with whom we've worked the past 5 years, nearly 5 years, although I know that's a very short tenure, we have never had a returner with the same problem because of the counseling we've been giving, the instruction. Now, I know this sounds judgmental, but I was debating the member of the school board in L.A. and on this issue, and she was recommending that in junior high we should put, she calls them sex education clinics, but what she meant was birth control pills and dispensing contraceptives and so on. I said, that's like giving out cookbooks and fat farms. it comes about the same thing. I said, what we need to do is educate the children not to do it. And I said, I happen to have been raised up. it's real simple. My father was an agnostic, and his father was an atheist. I didn't own a Bible when I grew up. When I graduated from public high school and was captain of the football team, so I think I knew what was happening inside the outfit, and I was into everything that I shouldn't have been. But I don't remember but one girl who got pregnant during the 4 years of school. And I want to tell you, we were no better than the kids are today. I mean, I know that. How come we didn't have a teenage pregnancy problem? That was before the pill, by the way. I finished high school in 1950. How come we didn't have a pregnancy? The issue was that my parents, and I repeat, my father's an agnostic, because of the cultural and social complications of premarital sex, said, I don't do that. And he didn't say it once, and I understood him, but he said it more than once. And I went off to school, and believe it or not, how judgmental, from the first grade, the school teacher said, don't do that. That'll complicate your life and hurt other people. Don't do it, don't do it. That wasn't religious. That was, and then I was telling the LA board member that occasionally when my mother, who was a Christian, took me to church, I heard the preacher saying, everybody who was an authority figure in my life was telling me, as an unbeliever, as far as Christianity is concerned, don't do it. And that's what all the other kids, and we didn't do it. And we've got to come back to education. We've got to come back to saying, hey, there's a reason not to do this kind of thing. Then you don't have the teenage pregnancy. But she spoke, well, that's judgmental. I said, yes, and it's just that kind of philosophy that you jugheads in education have today that has caused the problem that we're trying to clean up now. That's why the clinics, and that's why all the medical and social problems and cultural problems and single-parent situations and so on. And it's just unwilling to take a stand on what's right. And it's pure common sense. You don't have to get a law degree up here to know what I'm saying.
Thank you.
Next victim.
That would be me. Reverend... I cannot, well, I had a definite question when I came up here, but I have to make a comment. I am worried that a person of your ability and influence would draw an analogy between a Central Park mugger and the Soviet Union.
Well, there's not a great deal of difference.
That's a scary way to handle international politics. What I came up to ask you about was your support of education as compared to dogma. It appears to me that What you have done is mobilized a massive vote, which is a positive good in this country. We have a problem with voting. But I wonder if you're really mobilizing an educated vote. I don't think that through educating clergy to lay down certain viewpoints from the church pulpit without giving the other side of the argument or the other ideas or the other political parties or viewpoints or candidates that you're really educating. You're, in a way, propagandizing.
I hear what you're saying. Could you give me an illustration of another group, be it labor union, feminist group, whatever, that in fact does it that way?
Right here.
Where?
Are you telling me that this place is getting a
conservative point of view in the classroom every day?
But are they being given the liberal point of view every day? There are conservatives on this campus, and there are liberals. And each side talks to each other. That's what we're talking about. But what I'm wondering is, before, you had a 55%, I think you said, voting rate. Maybe that's because they weren't interested enough. Maybe that's because they didn't know what's going on. What you have done is mobilize that vote, from your own words, by mobilizing the church. Mm-hmm. Now, is the church providing them with both sides of the issue?
Well, let me ask this. Do you think the black churches were wrong 30 years ago doing that in the civil rights movement?
No, but I don't think that
is the difference? You know, the difference is that you and I disagree on where we're headed. If you would give me a list of five professors in the Harvard Law School who agree with what I've just said in my speech, then I believe you're pluralistic here. You know better, and I know better. And that's fine. You got $3.5 billion in endowment? You could pay off the federal debt. You don't have to ask anybody for anything. So you can do what you please. I happen to have a school called Liberty University. We accept no government funds. We have 7,500 students. We're 15 years old. And I run mine just like they run this one, just as discriminatory as possible towards our point of view and you towards yours. And what's fair for the liberal goose is fair for the conservative gander.
But I don't think my point's coming across as probably.
But you hadn't.
In our situation, we get both the liberal and the conservative point of views. But in the policies that you presented, such as censorship of pornography, which is a questionable thing as far as the U.S. Constitution is concerned, abortion, the handling of it in the churches, and the publicity that you give it, you do not seem to encourage education, but instead encourage dogma. And encouraging dogma here is fun because we all get the other side of the coin, but I'm worried that the average American will not get the other side of the coin, and I'm worried that you do not support education as much as you say you do.
Well, let me say that we are totally... Let me tell you that we are totally accredited, fully accredited. We are accredited as a liberal arts institution. We have 75 majors. Our professors, many of them right here, not many, some. don't expect miracles. But believe just as much as this school in liberal arts education. Remember, I'm the guy who brought Ted Kennedy down to speak in chapel. And I happen to believe that you can give both points of view, and you can certainly bring in the liberal arts education. But I also believe that you have the right at Harvard to be the bastion of liberalism. You can't deny that. Even Time Magazine knows that, and they don't know much. And and we are a bastion of conservatism. Now, when you talk about that's censorship. You take, for example, the pornography issue. We didn't censor pornography. We used our free enterprise privileges. We got several million Americans to stop buying from places that sold the porn. That had a profound effect. It is exactly the way, for example, the National Organization of Women, when the ERA didn't go through, began to boycott the states that didn't vote for them and stop taking conventions there. And they have every right to do that. If some national product, when Jesse Jackson goes to see Kellogg or General Foods or whatever, and if they're not willing to give them a little blackmail money and help push and so forth and so on, they stop buying those products. Now, whereas I would say, hey, that's censorship, the fact is that's free enterprise and Jesse has a right to do it, but we also have that right. And if a retailer wants to defy the customers and sell what they want, they have that right to do it. But it's all free enterprise. It's all within the system. It is all the American way. We violate no laws, and I think that of all places to be getting criticism on that, you're speaking on the wrong platform. Right over here.
I would like to ask, in speaking about national defense, you said that you wish we lived in a sweet world where self-defense would not be necessary. I'd like to apply that argument to your criticism of divorce, keeping in mind that one in three children in American families today are victims of incest, and that a woman is beaten every 18 seconds in this country.
Well, I have no problem with that argument at all. I
very strongly believe that divorce is a terrible thing, but I also believe that we have a responsibility to take people where they are, not where we wish they were. We preach the ideal to young people. And we tell them that the ideal, the very sensible ideal, is a lasting marriage and security for the children and love between all parties involved. But we also, and in our church, we practice that. We have a class for once marriage. They may be by divorce or being widowed or whatever, but primarily divorce. We have a class for young people who have been married once or more and who are not now married. That's the ministry. When our Lord met the woman at the well, he said, I'd like to talk to your husband. She said, I don't have one. He said, you might be right. You've had five. And you're living with somebody now to whom you're not married. But he didn't condemn her. He forgave her. And not only forgave her, sent her back to the city to tell what he had said to her, and she brought the whole city out. And he taught them. God doesn't take us as to where we ought to be, but where we are. I'm glad for that because, very frankly, I was very spiritually ignorant, didn't own a Bible, and through hearing a radio broadcast, Dr. Charles E. Fuller, I heard the gospel, the death, burial, resurrection of Christ, received the Lord as my Savior while studying to be a journalist in college. And my whole life was turned around, and I'm doing what I'm doing now. But all I can say is that everybody has their problems. We all have them. We preach the ideal of reach people where they are. Child abuse. It's a horrendous thing. And in our state, I don't know what the law is here, in our state, to show you how strict, and it's a good law, if a child is brought into Sunday school with bruises, I'm talking about a child with bruises, if the Sunday school teacher, now this is an area where I'm willing for the government to invade the church, if the Sunday school teacher knows and sees the injury that child has sustained, even though he or she is not sure what caused it, and does not report it, that Sunday school teacher can be prosecuted. And in fact, it happens around. And that is a good law, because little children can't defend themselves. And so we have a church of 22,000 members. And this is something that happens about once a year. Somebody will come in, bring a child into the nursery. And when the nursery worker's changing a diaper, they see bruises and cuts. And they call in their supervisor, who then calls the authorities. And we don't accuse anybody of anything. But we absolve ourselves of responsibility to that child and to the law. And very often it is brutality, it is child abuse, and very often the government will work with that and try to teach parenting to those parents and get our help as well. But where it can't be properly taught, the child's taken away from the parents. Nothing wrong with that at all. Thank you.
The United States and Russia just sort of made a trade, Danilov for Sakharov. And the Soviets seem to have gotten the first summit that they're going to have, like, next week. Do you think that that was a concession by the United States? And how do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, the trade was not just Danilov for a spy. But as you well know, was it Urlov who came? What's his name?
Orlov? Orlov.
And he's just here now. He, of course, a dissident. It was somewhat of a trade. But again, I come to the issue of the Christian and his principles. You know, I'm a pastor, and I never plan to run for any kind of public office because I think as a Christian and as a pastor, for me to abandon my call to the ministry, to step aside, for me would be a step down because it would not be what I believe God wants and has called me to do. I'm not criticizing Reverend Jackson, Father Drynan, Pat Rock. I'm talking about Jerry Falwell now. But I see a great problem with a pastor in the presidency. As I was saying at the dinner table to some of the students here, that foreign policy is an exercise in deceit. What you and I are reading may or may not be what's happening. And the game that's being constantly played between opponents, it's unreal. And whatever got us to Iceland, I'm not saying the end always justifies the means, but I'm saying looking at what did happen in that case, whatever it is, if it got us at least the beginning of a summit, whereas the total good of the world maybe is at stake, I do not think it was an unnecessary sacrifice.
What do you think should be the end result of the summit, in your opinion, if the way you see it?
Well, you know, of course, the Soviets are saying what they want is an end of testing. And we are saying we want some other things. But hopefully at some point in time, both of us will realize that that the arms race is so ridiculous, it is so massive, it is so foolish, it is so juvenile, that both of us have to realize that for our mutual good, we must not only stop it, but give impeccable inspection to the other side to look at what we have, and then hopefully we'll begin talking about a bill down. It will be a happy day when we don't have just arms reductions, but arms elimination. We have it's complicated. We're not the only two who have the bomb, and there are probably others getting it while I'm talking here now, at least working toward that. And when you have a few Gaddafis in the world, that's a matter of great alarm. It's very complicated and very difficult, but with the stakes that are involved at some point in time, and I have to believe there's at least some semblance of intelligence and desire for self-help in the Soviet Union, regardless of what their goals might be, at some point in time, hopefully, they, like we, would say, okay, come over and take a look at everything, let us do the same thing, and let's draw up a plan whereby we can start building down and building out and to make this a safe world for our children. What can hopefully be accomplished in a summit? Something in that direction. But God knows you'll be as old as I am when that has eventually become a reality, and I hope it does become one.
Dr. Falwell, I'd like to ask you, as an evangelical, how you feel about taking God's name out of the school? Don't you feel that the Constitution has been grossly misinterpreted in the issue of this sort of thing?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I did not answer the total question that the young man asked here a moment ago about the progress, I forgot who asked it, in the area of school prayers. We've made a tremendous advance in that. The Equal Access Bill, which passed 2 years ago, trying to think what the vote was. It was in the Senate, it was like 83 to 13, in the House, about the same proportion, now allows in the high schools of this country, not just evangelicals, any religious group, to have equal footing with any other group, social group, in before and after school, student-initiated, student-conducted meetings for any group in facilities not being used for the regular curriculum. We have been so pleased with that, and in fact across the country that is happening. Initiated by students, voluntary attendance, no adults brought in from the outside. Any religious group may do the same thing. Classrooms before and after, or facilities before and after school being used. And in our town, we're getting tremendous attendance, tremendous. We get great reports from the kids or the voluntary parents who tell us it's wonderful. And it's the law of the land. We can do it. Now, it's being challenged by the ACLU. It wouldn't be much if it weren't challenged by them. But it's being challenged by them right now. But I think it's going to stand because it's voluntary and everybody can do it. Jew, Muslim, you name it. The atheists can have their meetings, and so can the evangelicals. I think what you're driving at is the fact that we have so secularized our society that the mention of the name of God seems to be an anathema.
I think we've made the way for the drugs. I mean, when you take God out of the school or everything that's moral or ethical, then that's all you have left. And if there's no right or no wrong, then I think that's the moral decay of our land.
Well, absolutism, taken to its extreme, can be very, very damaging, particularly in a pluralistic school system. And so I understand why, and I would imagine you do as well, why the Muslim or the Christian or the Jewish Bible or whatever cannot be used in the public. I understand that. I do not understand why a voluntary prayer is damaging, or why we may in fact talk about a lot of things but never give equal time to God. I think that imposition of religion is clearly unconstitutional. I think it is wrong, for example, to bring Jerry Falwell or Cardinal O'Connor or Ezra Taft Benson of the Mormons in to speak to the student body. I mean, about religion. I think that's wrong. I don't think it's wrong to talk historically and ways of literature, but I think it's wrong to evangelize in the school system.
I'm not talking about
what that you're saying, so I was just trying to make my point clear that I think I know where you're headed, and I would agree with you, but I'm not willing to ask for, or even to accept, any kind of state church or imposition of one religion over another.
I'm not talking about that, but there was a time up until about the 1920s when there was a time when the Bible was the only textbook they had in the American schools. And Webster's Dictionary. Now all of a sudden, you know. And so there's no basis for saying that.
Well, I think that when we're talking about morality, when we're talking about the Judeo-Christian ethic, we very much would very much agree. The only thing that I would be super sensitive to, and I think that we have to be very careful about it, is that the public classroom. Now, we happen to have an elementary and a high school that the church owns. There are 34,000 of them, and we pay for it, just as Jewish yeshivas and the rabbis and synagogues pay for that. They have the right to teach Judaism. We have the right to teach Christianity totally. They don't have the right to teach that in the public school where my son attends, and I don't have the right to teach mine where their son. What I'm trying to say is it's a very sensitive. The country has become so pluralistic in recent years, so pluralistic. Whereas that would not have been the case perhaps 50 years, 60 years ago when your mother, my mother were in school and would not have created the problem. The philosophy, the real problem, the root of it was there. And I think that, I don't think that either you or I, anyone else here would like bringing a biblical dogma to the public classroom.
I'm not talking about a dogma.
I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate it. Do we have one more question? One more question.
My question is fairly simple because at present I'm not really interested in the logic of your arguments. I was just curious as to, earlier you were talking about the fact that you're willing to make concessions to reality on the abortion question insofar as, say, granting abortions to women who are raped. I was wondering if, were it necessary for a real politic to have, say, a complete pro-life amendment where no abortions were allowed, would it pain your conscience to think of the women who are raped and couldn't get abortions?
Well, may I ask, I don't know exactly what you're saying, so it'll be hard to put any logic in it, but I would say, what I mean is I don't know if you're against or for rape.
I don't care about that. I was curious as to your stance.
I gave you my stance a little while ago that I personally believe, as a Christian, I believe in the sanctity of unborn life, and I preach, and we take into our own. For last year, for example, at our Liberty Godparent home, we had two girls who called and asked for help. Both of them were pregnant by their father. They did not know where their mother was, hadn't seen her in quite a while. Called, their fathers were in jail where they ought to be. They called for help and said, would you take us in? The authorities locally in that particular state, it happened to be the state of Maryland, said yes. We'd like you to take them if you would. We took the two girls in. We had four children. We had the two children who were to be the mothers and the two children to be born, and we have found four adoptive homes for all of them now. And they are growing up and being, hopefully, their lives being reshaped, and they're being loved and cared for. I personally feel that is the ideal. I do not believe that pragmatically in a political solution you could have a law that disallows rape and incest and where the physical life of the mother is threatened as options for abortion. I think we can preach what I preach, but I don't think we can impose it. For example, I believe that birth control is a sensible approach to family planning. There are many others who do not believe that. I respect that view. I respect that view. But I don't think it's a practical one to impose upon the public. I don't think it can be imposed. I think it'd be as unimposable as prohibition was. But in realism, I do believe, and this may sound bad because it's logic, I think in realism, I think that we have to look at the reality that we are never and should never have a law that imposes a prohibition against birth control. We ought to teach families about responsible planning, but at the same time, rape, incest, life of the mother, in my opinion, will at least be the basic minimum in any law that is ever yet to come, and I personally feel that we would accept that quickly. We'd be very happy to have that. Thank all of you. He tells me that.
Reverend Falwell, I've waited 2 years to ask you this question. It takes 48 seconds. Do you have them?
You're on.
Okay. I am now going to read you a letter I wrote you a year ago tomorrow, okay, which you've never responded to and which I wish I'd never had to write, but I want your response tonight. I'm writing to you as a Christian about something that disturbs me greatly as a Christian. It has recently come to my attention that you have on several occasions recounted a story to, quote, entertain your audiences, describing part of your last visit to Harvard in the November of 84. I first ran across your funny story in the New Republic, the April 29th, 85, issue, and I just read the same thing in the July issue of Ms. At a Harvard Law School forum, a young woman who identified herself as a Jewish lesbian feminist asked you an incisive, intelligent question about your stance on abortion. Your reply was, quote, "Of all the people in the room, you have no reason to worry about abortion." You probably remember this. In retelling the story, you have made repeated derogatory remarks about this woman's appearance as well. For those of you who are fortunate enough not to have heard these remarks, let me give you an example. From the Dayton Daily News, and I quote Reverend Falwell, "She looked like the Lord made her as ugly as he could and then scared her. She was so big she could have played linebacker for Ohio State." I am outraged and disgusted at what you said, at your insensitivity and the cruelty of your remarks, and I'm frightened that such hurtful and hateful words should come from someone who professes to know the Prince of Peace. Both in your response to the woman at the time and in your subsequent remarks about her, you have never answered her actual question. Instead of having the courtesy to address her question, you have resorted to personal insult. This enlightens no one, discourages dialogue between people on both sides of the abortion issue, and most importantly, violates Christian principles.
It's 49 seconds. I'll be glad to answer it now. I did answer it that night, by the way. I answered the question that night on abortion, just as I did a moment ago for this young man. I am opposed to abortion, but pragmatically I believe that in the law, we ought to have rape, incest, and the physical life of the mother as a
I'm
part of the...
I'm interested in why you found it necessary to derogatory, make derogatory remarks about someone.
Tongue in cheek, and I may make one about you when I leave here. I probably will, but I just, very frankly, when you come up to a microphone and you in a very derisive way, as I remember she did, virtually almost a verbal attack, and says, "I am a liberal," what did she say, feminist,
Jewish, lesbian feminist.
Jewish, lesbian, whatever. I didn't know what she was, but everybody's got to be something. I simply answered her question. If I joked about it later, I apologize to you or her if she's here. May do it again, but I apologize. Anybody else? Is that it?
Thank you. Thank you to the people downstairs and upstairs. Thank you for coming. We look forward to seeing you all a week from Wednesday night here in Ames for Wilson Good. Thanks for coming.